Well, let me just raise something that you're all very, very familiar with, but it'll help fix our ideas a bit. Here's a picture of the standard time zones of the world. And of course, this is a convention we introduced for spreading the phasal clocks across the surface of the Earth. And of course, the price that we pay is the introduction of an international date line. One of the prices, maybe the biggest price. Why do we do this? Well, it's obvious why we do it, because the Earth is not lit by the sun all over all the time. So for example, here's Merry England up here. Let's suppose it's, I don't know, late afternoon. We don't want to give the same clock time to late afternoon in Britain, and let's say much later evening in Calcutta. It just wouldn't make any, it wouldn't be practical. So we choose our times to suit the local zones in an obvious way. But notice what these time zones remind us is that we spread time or phase across space on grounds of convenience. Now, I've heard recently, I was in South Bend at the University of Notre Dame, and somebody told me that a small region around South Bend had a different time at one stage from the rest of the state. Yeah. I don't know whether that's the word convenience is the right word here, but certainly it's a convention. I mean, this isn't something laid down, as it were, some sort of fundamental structure of the universe. So largely speaking, I mean, broadly speaking, we introduced these time zones to best suit our interests. But as a result, we may end up traveling backwards in time. Now, I don't know if you've ever had the good luck of being in a place like New Zealand or Australia. But every time you fly from New Zealand and you arrive somewhere on the East Coast of the Americas, you literally arrive before you left. I've done this many times. I bet I did it a few weeks ago. Now, amazingly, apart from the usual jet lag, nothing very much happens to you. Your head doesn't explode or anything. You've been a time traveler. You've arrived before you left, but not very much happens to you. Now, you might say, well, come on, this is just an artifact of where we place the international time zone. But bear this in mind. Bear this example in mind, because I'll come back to it. Yes, it is an artifact. We shouldn't be so surprised that we don't suffer anything worse than just jet lag. But nonetheless, we do this to ourselves out of convenience. But also, it makes us ask ourselves the question, well, here's New Zealand, and you leave at a certain time, and you naturally ask yourself, well, suppose an event is occurring in New Zealand, and an event is occurring in Waterloo. Are they simultaneous, really? Forget all this stuff about spreading time through space. Isn't there a fact of the matter as to whether the two events are simultaneous? Well, let's not think so much about Waterloo and New Zealand. Let's just think about two clocks on the table. Can't you just tell by looking? I'm asking myself, are those two clocks synchronized? Don't they look synchronized? Can't you just tell by looking at them? Doesn't it seem sort of just straightforward whether you can tell whether they're synchronized or not? But notice I put one clock slightly further away than the other. So if the light from the two clocks hits my eyes simultaneously, and they look exactly the same, aren't you going to start to wonder whether they're really synchronized? Shouldn't you account for the fact that the light takes a little bit longer to arrive from one clock than the other? What's going on here? I mean, after all, we wouldn't be doing physics unless we were trying to be absolutely accurate. But now the question arises, okay, I'm going to compensate for this little difference. I'm going to take into account how long, you know, the difference in distance to my eyes from the clocks to see whether they're really synchronized. But in order to do this, I have to make an assumption. I have to make an assumption that the speed of one-way speed of light from that clock to my eye is the same as the one-way speed of light from that clock to my eye. Good. That seems pretty natural. The one-way speed of light is isotropic, isn't it? You can do anything you want. You can put yourself anywhere you like. I'm just asking the question, how do I know that the one-way speed of light from that clock to my eye is the same as the one-way speed of light that I'm microphone. And by the way, this isn't a question about light. This is a question about any signal at all. Take any signal. Take a moving car. Take a baseball in motion. Anything you like. How do you know what its one-way speed is? How do you test the one-way speed? How do you measure the one-way speed of any signal? Suppose you know the distance involved between the beginning point and the end point of the journey. How do you measure the one-way speed? I have no issue with how you measure the two-way speed. You need a single clock. You send the thing out. It comes back. You know the distance. You have a single clock. You can measure the time it takes for the whole journey. That's no problem. That's perfectly straightforward. How do I do it in the case of a one-way signal? How do I measure one-way signal velocity? Assuming I know the distance to arbitrary accuracy, how do you do it? Yeah, you have to synchronize your clock. You've got to have synchronized clocks at the beginning, at the end. Go ahead.
Measure how long it takes this one to travel from here to our eyes. But when we see at this 2 o'clock, and then if the light things goes inside our eyes, but how do we know that we understand that they're the same exactly? Because maybe it takes even more time to realize that this one is exactly, is simultaneous to that one when we look at the left eye from the right.
I mean,
it depends on us and how we can understand that in an exam.
There are a number of complications, of course, that I'm just ignoring. But I mean, you could imagine, for example, a focal point for the two rays of light, absolutely the same place, so I don't have to worry about stereoscopic vision or anything like that. I'm just trying to simplify the matter. I'm just asking, I really want to boil this down to this very, very simple question. Is measuring a one-way speed of anything the same as measuring a two-way speed of anything? The answer is no. The two-way speed can be measured by a single clock. The one-way speed can only be established operationally by having two synchronized clocks. How do you synchronize clocks? Well, is this a convention or is it somehow God-given? Let's ask ourselves just historically. By the way, the first person who was really raising this question systematically, as far as I know, was Poincaré. And the reason that Poincaré raised these questions is because he was involved with telegraphy, the burgeoning telegraphy industry, and he suddenly realized that there was no straightforward, unambiguous way of measuring the one-way speed of any telegraphic message. You needed to have synchronized clocks, the beginning point and end point. And then the question arose, well, how do you synchronize them, and is this not merely a convention? The trouble with the more you delve into Poincaré, the more you realize that he used the word convention for just about everything. Just about everything in the end turned into a convention for Poincaré, including the geometry of space. But I think in this particular instance, he was really onto something. So anyway, what Poincaré said was, look, let's make life simple for ourselves. Let's choose a convention that's natural, given what we know about the two-way speed. What experiment in physics, and I'll have to ask forgiveness from our friends in UWO, because we were talking about this just the other day. What experiment do you appeal to that establishes that the two-way speed of light is isotropic? You all know it. I've already mentioned it. It's the Michelson-Morley experiment. That's the whole point of the experiment. You have an interferometer. It's registering certain interference fringes. You rotate the interferometer, nothing happens. The interferometric fringes are measuring the difference between the two-way speeds, as it were, in the two arms. When you rotate the thing, nothing happens. It means that the two-way speed of light is isotropic. So Poincaré's point was this. If we know that the two-way speed is isotropic, why choose a convention other than that which establishes the one-way speed of light is isotropic? So in other words, synchronize your clocks in such a way that the one-way speed of light is isotropic. Fair enough? This is the so-called Poincaré-Einstein convention. It's more usually in the context of special relativity, it's referred to as the Einstein convention for synchronizing distant clocks. And it is absolutely explicit in this 1905 paper. It's absolutely explicit. And now Einstein, why was this so important for Einstein to make this explicit? Because Einstein could not understand the relativity of simultaneity in the Lorentz transformation. He had his postulates, he had his derivation, out popped the Lorentz transformations, but that relativity of simultaneity factor really bothered him. Isn't there a fact of the matter about whether two events are simultaneous? If there is, how can it become coordinate dependent and still stay consistent with the relativity principle? But you see, if it turns out that two events being simultaneous is not, there's no matter of fact as to whether they're simultaneous, but effectively it's the result of a convention, then who's to say that relatively moving observers choosing a particular convention are going to end up saying that the events are, they're going to end up agreeing about which events are simultaneous. But look, just coming back to this, let's just look once again. The Poincaré-Einstein convention is the convention whereby we choose to synchronize clocks in such a way as to make the one-way speed of light isotropic. Now, I've just got a reminder to myself, avoid thinking of it operationally. When you walk into a typical physics laboratory that involves motion, you know, you're measuring the motions of bodies or something, how many times have you seen clocks all over the walls and physicists aiming at them with laser beams to synchronize them? Ever seen that? I haven't. But they're not lunar ranging. They're not synchronizing distant clocks. They're just measuring how long it takes for the light from a single laser source to hit that mirror and bounce back again. It's a two-way experiment. The issue is really this. We're not actually setting up in space when we do experiments synchronized clocks. What we're doing is we're choosing a coordinate system. That's all we're doing. We're describing what's going on according to some coordinate system. And the coordinate system has temporal coordinates that are spread in such a way that ordinarily when we describe light, it turns out that light, our theoretical description, is isotropic with respect to the one-way speed. In other words, this is not a question of setting up synchronized clocks. It's just a question of what coordinate systems you choose. Because the minute you take two events at a distance, given a coordinate system, the coordinates will tell you whether they're simultaneous or not because the two events will have to have the same t value. So just introducing a coordinate system is already, if it's going to be a useful one, is already to fix a convention about synchronizing clocks, were they there, but they don't have to be.
Einstein and Poincaré were concerned with synchronizing clocks, were they not? It was, first of all, not in the physics, but in the practical application, Poincaré was really concerned with setting up that picture of the Earth with the time zones and
that's true. And Poincaré may have been. I don't think Einstein was.
What does it mean to set up a coordinate system if you haven't synchronized clocks?
It's simply to give temporal coordinates to
events.
To events, yeah.
And why is that not the same as synchronizing clocks?
Because I don't have to have any clocks to synchronize. When I study Maxwell's equations, for example, I mentioned writing down Maxwell's equations with respect to certain Cartesian coordinates with a time coordinate as well. Now, I choose the coordinate that makes those equations look simplest. I'm not introducing clocks into the world.
So maybe we should have discussed this back in the first half when we were discussing what a clock is. But isn't a clock the thing that you need to get what are the time coordinates of an event?
No. The clock tells you what the duration is between two events at the same place. Now I'm referring to the phase aspect of the clock. Now I want to know whether this event occurs at the same phase of the clock as that event. I'm not interested in duration anymore. I'm interested in a global feature of the phases of these clocks, as it were. Or more metaphysically, I'm just interested in whether these two events are simultaneous. What does it mean to say two events are simultaneous? What does it really mean? Yeah.
Well, I prefer to define simultaneity in a non-equality relation matter in terms of whether or not the two events can signal to whether or not one event can signal to the other.
In principle.
That gets around the question by
But that's far too weak. That's too weak.
Right.
It's not going to pick out a unique coordinate system.
That's right.
Anything like a unique coordinate system. But after all, when we're doing physics, we're always, you know, if we're writing down the laws of some, you know, some particular interaction, we're writing them down with respect to, we start at least with an inertial coordinate system in general. Of course, we might want to make it generally covariant. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, we're doing something like Maxwell theory. We can understand what we mean by these Cartesian coordinates, plus their spatial coordinates, plus these time standard time coordinates, without thinking that every time you're studying Maxwell's equation, you have to think of physical clocks being spread through space. We're simply choosing coordinates relative to which those very equations tell us the one-way speed of light is isotropic. I mean, isn't that what Maxwell's equations exactly tell us, given the usual coordinates? We solve Maxwell's equations for free propagating waves, and it turns out the wave velocity, turns out the velocity of those waves is exactly c, the one-way velocity. That just tells us we've chosen nice coordinates, temporal coordinates. We could have chosen other coordinates. Let me make this point perhaps slightly clearer by looking at what Poincaré was doing. Poincaré, as I say, he understood that if something conventional was going on, you define one-way speeds. Because alternatively, it's either a question of choice of coordinate systems or, in certain instances, whether you want to measure the one-way speed, then you need to have synchronized clocks. And the question is, how do you synchronize them? Is there some royal standard or something about synchrony conventions? By the way, we have to be careful here, because the synchrony convention we use in special relativity isn't necessarily the one we use in classical mechanics. When robbers are about to rob a bank, and they get together for their last, you know, they get together and they compare their watches, because everyone has different operations that are extremely well timed, and they go into the bank and do their various things. It's all very well synchronizing them at a point, but how do they know whether two of the distant events are simultaneous? Well, they're using a convention for spreading the time, the phase of time through space, called clock transport. Try and do that in special relativity and see what happens. You're going to get trouble. If the clocks go very fast, and you transport them around and you synchronize all your clocks that way, you're going to get into trouble. It will not be the same as the Einstein-Poincaré synchrony convention. Look, but Poincaré actually said that the similar problem arises even in classical mechanics. It's nothing to do with special relativity. After all, the question that I raised before was, how do you measure the one-way speed of a signal? I didn't say it was a relativistic signal. I said it wasn't necessarily light. It could be a car or a baseball or anything you like. This is a general question, just a very, very simple, basic kinematical question. What does it mean to say that there's a conventionality of simultaneity in Newtonian mechanics? And this is something that Poincaré himself said at one stage, if you're doing celestial mechanics, we normally set up a coordinate system, a very, very big, spatially spread out Cartesian coordinate system. We have temporal coordinates, which make Newton's laws of motion simple, etc. Not just because we've chosen these affine, you know, we have a parameter which makes the equations look simple, but also we spread the phase, we spread these coordinates across space in a very simple way, that what? What does it do? Well, what is Newtonian mechanics? First of all, what's the first law of motion, the law of inertia? The law of inertia says x double dot is equal to zero. What is its symmetry group? What coordinate transformations can you introduce that preserve the form of that equation? Well, any linear transformation of the coordinates. In particular, we could introduce that coordinate transformation. And that's going to preserve the form of the law of inertia. X double dot is equal to zero. So if we just had the law of inertia, we would have no notion of simultaneity. Nothing in the behavior of just freely moving bodies pricks out a privileged simultaneity relation. Because even if we choose one, we could just introduce this linear transformation of the temporal coordinates, which shifts our simultaneity planes, and we still get the same equation. So if there's going to be a privileged simultaneity relation in classical mechanics, it has to be because of the existence of forces. And by the way, this is obviously has to be the case because that law of inertia, x double dot is equal to zero, also lives in special relativity. A free body is going to move inertially in special relativity. So this is a law that both theories share. So if we're going to have relativity of simultaneity in the second theory, it had better not be because of the law of inertia. Okay, so the law of inertia is not picking out a preferred simultaneity relation. What is? Well, it's forces. Now, why do forces do that? Because the gravitational force is said to be instantaneous. And a lot of people say the difference between classical mechanics and special relativity is that in special relativity, we have a finite maximum speed of propagation. Whereas in Newtonian mechanics, we have an infinite speed. But again, we're talking about one-way speeds. How do you know that you only have a finite one-way speed of light in special relativity? And how do you know that you have an infinite one-way speed of, say, the gravitational interaction? Doesn't it depend on how you synchronize your clock? So again, the difference really is the following. It's natural in Newtonian mechanics to choose temporal coordinates in such a way that the gravitational interaction is instantaneous and isotropic. Otherwise, you're going to introduce problems for yourself. But you could do it. In other words, you could do something like you could choose a standard Newtonian coordinate system. And you could introduce one of these linear coordinate transformations. So you shift. You shift your simultaneity hypersurface, and you have a gravitating body here, and you have a gravitating body, let's say, over here. Now, in the standard coordinates that you've chosen, these things interact with each other instantaneously. So the round trip effect, this affects that back, that's going to take place in zero time. But the effect that the gravitational interaction is isotropic, it's instantaneous everywhere. But if you shift your simultaneity plane, then this thing is going to operate into the past. The gravitational interaction will operate into the past in that direction. But in that direction, it'll operate into the future. But the round trip is the same. It's zero, zero time. Now, why would anyone in their right minds introduce such a coordinate system? Now, you might say, well, because metaphysics tells us that causes have to precede the effects. But this isn't a case of metaphysics. This is just a case of choosing a coordinate system. You might say, well, because something terrible would happen if this causal influence went into the past. But this is no different from crossing the international date line. It's just time travel because of some strange, it's an artifact of the coordinate system we choose. It's not changing the landscape of events. You wouldn't make any errors in any of your physics if you use this coordinate system. As long as you correspondingly change the laws of physics. You have to introduce a compensating factor in the Newton's gravitational law. And this is what Poincaré realized. You can always just, you can choose different simultaneity conventions, but there'll be one that's simplest. Now, why is that intrinsically any different from what we do in special relativity? We choose a coordinatization of space-time, which makes the one-way speed of light isotropic, because any other choice is going to appear arbitrary and going to introduce, as an artifact, an anisotropy in the one-way speed of light. But now the question is this really a convention or not? Well, this is what gives rise to an enormous literature in the philosophical domain, huge literature about whether this is conventional, whether it's not conventional, whether it's imposed by the geometry of space-time. I might just mention in passing, by the way, that one of the most famous papers on this subject, which changed the views of many philosophers from being conventionalists to non-conventionalists about distance simultaneity, is based on a space-time which, if you look at its state space, the behavior of the system is a point. That's to say, remember I was saying before that if you're going to have time in your theory, it had better be that you have, let's say, a multiplicity of configurations. But this particular argument only has one. There's no change. So there's really no time to begin with. So I find it very odd that we use a paper describing a space-time that has no time in it to give us information about distance simultaneity. David Malamud's paper. Anyway, it's well known in the philosophy literature. I just mentioned that as an aside. So this is a tremendously controversial issue. Well, here I've got a slide which just, again, more or less repeats what I was saying before. Simultaneity is ill-defined in Newtonian mechanics until action at a distance, forces like gravity or magnetism are considered. That's what makes certain choices of coordinates natural, useful. And it can be defined, the same simultaneity relation, whether you use the gravitational interaction or whether you use transport of clocks, it turns out not to matter. You'll get exactly the same synchrony convention. This is just a feature of Newtonian dynamics. But other simultaneity conventions could be used, but they would be inconvenient or complicated. And this is the point that Poincaré was making. Incidentally, I'm going to make a final remark in relation to Newtonian mechanics that repeats something that Lee said earlier, which I think is dead right. But this is taking us on a whole different, this is very tangential. There are no convincing grounds in Newtonian physics for the notion of the flow of time. You don't need special relativity. There's a landscape of events. Newtonian mechanics, if it's true, tells us that there are certain patterns in these events. And we characterize these patterns by appealing to the laws of physics. But there's nothing in that account that says that there is a line of events, as it were, a hyperplane of events that are lit up, the now events, and that that thing moves through time, for some external time. Nothing like that is suggested in Newtonian mechanics. At least it seems to me. Well, finally, I'm going to move on to the relativity of simultaneity. Of course, Einstein argues that the simultaneity relation depends on the state of motion of the observer. And again, this just follows from the fact that alpha is equal to v over c squared. And as I mentioned before, this follows immediately from the fact that if you have two frames in relative motion, if you choose the Einstein-Poincaré convention in one and the Einstein-Poincaré convention in the other, even if the two-way speed of light is not invariant, you're going to end up with that relativity of simultaneity factor. It's just a consequence of how you have synchronized your clocks. And as I mentioned before, Einstein found this puzzling, perhaps even paradoxical, until he realized that there was no fact of the matter, and I think he probably learned this through Poincaré's writings, maybe directly or indirectly. There's no fact of the matter about whether two events are simultaneous in the first place. That's the so-called conventionality of distance simultaneity. Already in a single frame, it just depends on how you choose your coordinates. Or, talking more operationally, how you synchronize clocks at a distance. But there's no fact of the matter as to which is the right way. Now, that isn't to say that there aren't useful ways or simpler ways than other ways. But again, you're not going to go to jail if you do Newtonian mechanics using those funny coordinates. You're just going to make life a little bit complicated for yourself. Now, coming back to the issue of what time is. Well, if time has something to do with change, and change means multiplicity, the configuration of the world comes in heaps. So we can talk about, a transition, as it were, from one to another, or we just think of the heap as a single entity. Normally we think, if we think sort of cosmologically, we think, well, the configuration of the world is defined at an instant, which means we're talking about the relative distances of, say, all the particles in the universe at a given time, at a given instant. And that is going to be, and then we can think of another different, significantly different one, observably different one, and an observably different one, these configurations, and when you put them all together, you get time. But what did it mean to talk about the configuration at a time? Because of the relativity of simultaneity, according to a moving observer, that instant now looks, that simultaneity hypersurface is shifted with respect to the first observer. And now the configurations are defined with respect to a different hypersurface. So the notion of time, the heap is now a different heap, because its configuration is defined with respect to different instantaneous arrangements. So what are we supposed to conclude here? If time is change, and there's relativity of simultaneity, if we take it seriously, then either there are many times, or there's none at all. In the sense that there's just a landscape of events. They're all just laid out once and for all. And we just happen, because we have a certain state of motion, to slice these things into instantaneous configurations. But it doesn't matter whether you do it that way or some other way. But what's really out there is just the so-called block universe. So it seems, so many philosophers, for example, use the relativity of simultaneity to bolster this idea that what's the reality of the universe is a block universe rather than anything that's undergoing some process of becoming. But you really don't need special relativity. That's to say, I think it simply makes, it strengthens the position that the image that you have from classical mechanics, that there's nothing in classical mechanics that gives you a flow of time, and the situation is even clearer, as it were, in special relativity. Now, finally, I just wanted to finish with one remark. The relativity of simultaneity is often used as an explanatory account of things, and one has to be a little bit careful. Suppose you say to yourself, well, let's do special relativity without assuming the Einstein-Poincaré convention. Let's parameterize the anisotropy of the one-way speed of light. Let's introduce a parameter. This is what Reichenbach did famously, the so-called Reichenbach epsilon parameter. And that parameter for a given observer simply determines the degree of anisotropy of the one-way speed of light. So now imagine writing the Lorentz transformations now in terms not just of v's, the relative speed between the two frames, but also in terms of the epsilon with respect to the unprimed observer and the epsilon prime with respect to the moving observer. Okay? Now you just rewrite all that algebra, introducing these artificial, as it were, anisotropies in the one-way speed of light. And you can do it, and these are called the Edwards-Winney transformations, and I wouldn't dream of writing them down because they're horribly complicated. If you use them, you can get all the standard predictions of special relativity, because you're doing nothing more than introducing funny coordinates. And if you go back to the, if you transform these back to the isotropic case, you just get back to Lorentz transformations all over again. But the interesting thing is that you can choose these epsilon and psi prime values for the two frames to make the relativity of simultaneity disappear. And you don't get any results that are different from ordinary special relativity. Yeah. And for example, in the case where I'm not going to be able to spell this properly. Schrodinger and Tangalini wrote down the following transformations in special relativity. In the 1+1 dimensional case, there's no relativity of simultaneity because the alpha is zero, but there is time dilation. No relativity of simultaneity. Now, what they did was to choose a very, in the unprime frame, they just chose the standard Einstein-Poincaré convention. But in the moving frame, that shows a very, very special anisotropy for the one-way speed of light that depended on that relative speed, was very artificial, in such a way as to get rid of the relativity of simultaneity. Now, that is perfectly consistent with everything we know in special relativity. It's just that when you write down Maxwell's equations, for example, in that moving frame, you're going to get the most horrible anisotropies appearing. It's a little bit like doing the hydrogen atom in quantum mechanics using Cartesian coordinates instead of spherical polar coordinates. You can do it. You won't be sent to jail, but you're just making life complicated for yourself. But the interesting thing about this is, of course, all of the predictions of special relativity are contained in this theory, including the clock retardation effect. Remember, we were looking at twins, one of them staying at home, so the world line is like that, and the other one going out and coming back again. Now, very often, that clock retardation effect is explained by way of the relativity of simultaneity. And people say, the simultaneity planes, when the moving twin turns around, suddenly shift from that angle to that angle, and is missing time. But according to this account, there is no relativity of simultaneity. But you still get exactly the same clock retardation effect. So maybe we should just be a little bit careful. There is clearly, a lot of people would argue there is something conventional about the way we synchronize clocks. There is something conventional about the very meaning of a one-way speed. If that's the case, then there is something very conventional also about the relativity of simultaneity, to the extent that we can still do special relativity and do away with it. But of course, you pay a price in the sense that these coordinates that you're using have very, very, make the equations of motion in general very, I mean, the equations, the field equations, whatever the theory is, very complicated. But nonetheless, that you will predict the clocks will retard in the usual way in the twin paradox case. I think I'd like to leave it at that, Lee, and open it up for discussion.
Okay. You want to start?
Go ahead, Chris.
The question about the issue of conventionality, probably the more general question about the scientific theory. The debates about conventionality earlier were very tied to specific views about the areas for the views about the possibility of using temporal order to causal or something of that sort. The question is, in your view, what then is the significance of conventionality? Is it related to some of these other issues? Or if you could say something about that.
I always get a bit nervous when the word causality comes up. Of course, there are, in special relativity, we do have the light cone structure and with the absolute elsewhere, and we can causally, there are situations because we believe we can't have a signal that travels faster than the speed of light in a two-way sense, then there are going to be patches of space-time that are in that sense causally disconnected from each other. But the issue about the conventionality of distance and simultaneity is essentially just a choice of coordinate system of coordinatization of space-time. It seems to me of a very different order. I don't know whether that's...
Do you think the conventionality of reveals something deep about, say, the structure of special relativity, or about the nature of scientific theory in general? I think earlier, conventionality does reveal something of that sort. But it seems to you it really is just the consequence of general variance here.
Can I try to clarify this? Chris, are you asking, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Are you asking the following question? If the relativity of simultaneity is completely conventional, if there is really no factor of the matter to whether two space-like events, there is a factor of the matter to whether two events are space-like, but if there is really no factor of the matter to whether two space-like events are simultaneous with respect to some given observer or not, it is the claim that this is because there's no, that there's nothing we would want to explain whose explanation would require at some point saying observer A sees these two events as simultaneous and therefore. That is it that we're puzzled, we think, well, this relativity of simultaneity still leaves us with an observer-dependent notion of simultaneity. And it is your point that that's really vacuous, that is, this observer-dependent notion of simultaneity is purely conventional because there's no fact of the matter, there's no explanation that actually depends on it or uses it in, say, special relativistic field theories.
I think one has to be a little bit careful here because it's a bit like the gauge freedom. So if something is gauge dependent, we normally say that it doesn't exist. On the other hand, when we fix a gauge and ask for the value of some physical parameter is, the relationship between that value and the gauge is physical.
That is, it can be expressed in a gauge invariant.
Yeah, that can be expressed in a gauge invariant way. So, for example, if you've chosen a particular convention for synchronizing distant clocks, then there's a fact of the matter about what the speed of a one, you know, one-way speed of a system
within
is.
Within that convention.
But I would say that fundamentally, whether two distant events are simultaneous or not, there's no fact of the matter about this. And this doesn't have anything to do with special relativity. And I think Poincaré was right to stress the continuity between Newtonian mechanics and special relativity. There is one difference. There is one difference. If you choose funny coordinates in classical mechanics, you inevitably face this problem that the causal influences will propagate into the past.
Well, by which you mean the one difference is that because there is instantaneous force in Newtonian mechanics, that instantaneous force acts to define planes of simultaneity and moments of simultaneity globally. That is, you move something here and other things feel the force.
But you've chosen a coordinate system to make it instantaneous.
Let me just back up. Chris, does this address what you were saying?
I think it's a very interesting discussion. By the way, I can measure the two-way speed of this by the reverb effect. So it's somewhat hard to ask an extended question. But my question may be more simply put is just, why is conventionality interesting? Or previous generations of philosophers have very specific reasons why conventionality is interesting related to other issues of philosophy and science. And I'm asking Margaret, is conventionality interesting in his case or some other general issues in philosophy of science? Or is it just the, I think sometimes Europe represented as just another feature of coordinates, freedom or something like that?
I can't understand why this thing has created such a big literature. I have to say, I find that hard to understand. I mean, once you think about what you mean by one-way speeds, then it seems to me that the mystery pretty much disappears. On the other hand, I think a lot of people do have this intuition that there is actually a matter of fact as to whether two events are simultaneous, at least with respect to a certain frame of reference, that's to say a certain state of motion. And maybe that's what, but I feel myself that the issue of the conventionality of distance simultaneity has created far, far too much discussion. I think it's a relatively trivial issue myself. But once one sees what it is, then one looks at, for example, explanations depending on the relativity of simultaneity with a different eye. But I think nowadays, for example, in philosophy, the dominant position in philosophy, which I find very odd, is that yes, there's relativity of simultaneity between different moving observers. But for a given observer, There's a matter of fact as to whether two events are simultaneous. And I have to say, I find that a rather odd position to take. And certainly, I think for Einstein, it was very important for him to realize that the relativity of simultaneity really only makes sense given that even with respect to a single observer, there's no matter of fact as to whether two events, distant events, are simultaneous.
I don't know, maybe it's a crazy question, but what is the problem if you say we don't have any simultaneity for two events, unless we say we have kind of uncertainty to detect, and you say that there are somebody would like to say, for example, these two are not simultaneity, but with a kind of uncertainty, which satisfies all observers when you find this.
Well, where does the uncertainty come from?
Because of different observers that we have that can agree with this certain simultaneity.
Are you saying that because of relativity of simultaneity and special relativity, is that the source of this uncertainty?
I am. But so if we postulate this and then start from this point and say, okay, the nature has the kind of this structure that two objects can be simultaneous, but with kind of uncertainty, and then continue on that and then drive everything from this. And then drive the relativity and do the stuff from this. Because you postulate that one and then drive this one.
I'm not sure that it really makes sense, because to understand whether or not there's relativity of simultaneity presupposes that you know, presupposes that you have some method of spreading the phase of time through space. And that's exactly what's at stake here.
So because we think that we have to have two events which are simultaneous or not, it's because of that.
No, it's not because of that. It's because the relativity of simultaneity is a property of coordinate transformation. To have well-defined coordinate transformations, like these ones,
You
have to know what the original coordinates are. You have to say what these coordinates mean. And in particular, you have to say why you've chosen to put temporal coordinates in the way that you have. Because the minute you have a coordinate system, you can define a simultaneity relation in relation to those coordinates. The whole point of having a coordinate system. It gives you a simultaneity relation on a plate. Now the question is why those coordinates, not some other coordinates. So I don't think you can start with the relativity of simultaneity as a given fact. You have to understand, first of all, what the choice of those specific coordinates, what that choice is based on.
No, but if we go the other way, if we say, okay, our possibility is that we have uncertainty and define the simultaneity, so this gives us a choice of coordinate system, and it gives us, so you can choose this coordinate system as a coordinate system if you want, and you know we have more.
Okay, but then it sounds like the uncertainty is in relation to a single observer, not to a pair of observers. So we're trying to describe what's going on in the world. I choose a particular frame of reference that has a particular speed with respect to other frames of reference. Now I choose a certain frame of reference. Now I want to know, does it make sense for me to say of two events, distant events, whether they're simultaneous, with respect to that reference system. Now, why should there be any uncertainty? Because it's conventional, or because there's some intrinsic uncertainty associated with it? I'm just asking what your intuition is.
My intuition is, if when I go that way, so I can say, okay, because of the uncertainty that we have in defining that.
Okay, so there's a conventionality issue here.
Yeah.
Okay. But just because you have a conventionality issue doesn't necessarily mean, for example, in the Galilean transformations, you don't get a relativity of simultaneity. So the conventionality itself doesn't necessarily impose a relativity of simultaneity. It depends on the theory.
Actually, if we go that way, we can have a definition of like what is a clock or no, because I mean we can define this clock like something that's phase of the clock.
Yeah.
But I don't think more of this. I think it's maybe it's possible actually.
Let me try. Yeah. Maybe we should think about that. Could there be, so you have been discussing Einstein's theory of special relativity. Could there be a theory which was Poincaré invariant, but where there was a matter of fact about distance simultaneity, perhaps relative to an observer, perhaps not? So what I have in mind is, I mean, what if we had some version of Poincaré invariant quantum theory or quantum field theory with some addendum that said there is collapse of the wave function, and the collapse of the wave function takes place along the surface of simultaneity in the center of mass frame of the interaction or something like that.
Sure.
So special relativity is not equivalent to Poincaré invariance. It's equivalent to Poincaré invariance plus the statement that there is nothing else that would give a matter of fact for distance simultaneity. Am I making any sense?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think special relativity is the last word on this. I really don't think special relativity is the last word. We may find that through thinking more sort of globally, there's a particular furniture of the world that does seem to pick out either dynamical processes like the collapse of the wave function, of course, although to make actually the whole theory of Lorentz covariant or Poincaré invariant would be almost impossible. I mean,
well, nobody succeeded.
Nobody succeeded so far. Nobody succeeded.
And that doesn't look like a winning direction to pursue,
no.
But anyway.
But what about when we've got a general relativity? I mean, you were raising a possibility before about sort of global structure in general relativity that might pick out a very foliation.
Well, and every once in a while people raise the following example. Supposing that the global topology of space-time, we could say this within special relativity, supposing that the global topology of space-time was a torus. So there was an identification of this wall with that wall, that wall with that wall, that wall with that wall. And the resulting space-time metric is a quotient of Minkowski space-time by some discrete action, which makes those identifications. All the laws of physics could still have the same Poincaré invariance. Nonetheless, that discrete action picks out a preferred frame of simultaneity. And so one can imagine a theory which has laws which are Lorentz invariant or Poincaré invariant, nonetheless a global structure which picked out a preferred state of rest or preferred notion of simultaneity. And that would be consistent with special relativistic field theory.
I think that would be consistent. However, whether calling these things simultaneous does any work. I mean, it's true that there is something in the universe which is picking out a preferred foliation. I suppose it would be natural in that case, to say that events on the hypersurface were simultaneous, because that would make sense. If it means anything. Okay. Yeah, I think so. I honestly don't think that the symmetries, Lorentz covariance is by no means the whole story in relation to simultaneity. But in the absence of such a privileged structure, then it does seem to me that Poincaré and Einstein were basically right. There's a certain conventionality involved. That doesn't mean to say that some conventions are as simple to use as others. It just means you can use the others and still make the same predictions. So it's not really an empirical issue, it's an issue about elegance and simplicity.
Okay. Any other questions, comments, questions from Western? Okay, well, let's thank Harvey again.